All right, it is Saturday, November 15th, 2014. My name is Tim Mate, and today I have the privilege of interviewing Mr. Thomas Stevens at the Kresge Library on the campus of Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. Mr. Stevens, do I have your permission to record this interview today?
Yes.
All right, good, thank you. Well, today I wanted to talk today about your involvement in the environmental justice field, specifically Detroit. Just to start with, can you give me maybe just a brief summary of your education, work, and professional experiences so far?
I grew up downriver in Trenton, went to Trenton High School, went to the University of Michigan Residential College in the late 70s, graduating in 1981, took a year off and went abroad, came back here, went to law school at Wayne State between 1982 and 1986, took an extra year doing that, and I've been a people's lawyer in Detroit ever since. I work for the government right now.
Okay. What do you do with the government then?
I'm a policy analyst for the Detroit City Council.
Okay, thank you. All right, since we're talking about environmental justice, I guess let's just start with the basics. The EPA defines environmental justice, and this is quoting directly from their website, as the fair treatment of meaningful involvement of all people regardless of race, color, sex, national origin, or income with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. From with that, what do you feel your definition, or how would you describe environmental justice?
Well, that's fine as definitions go, except one has moved to the observation that what is attributed to Gandhi. It would be nice if somebody tried it, right? You know, environmental justice is intended to be the social justice, civil rights aspects of environmental policy and protection. The history of the EPA shows that from the very beginning, the very first director, since the definition is from the EPA, the very first director, Ruckelshaus, was asked about this question at one of the first, if not the first, congressional hearing, and they recognized that there would be tremendous social and economic implications of the agency's mission, and he went out of his way to say that this would be a strictly technical and scientific agency. And I think the growth of the environmental justice movement is sort of a historic reflection and pushback against that, because by looking at it in a purely technical sense, these other inherently bound up issues of race, class, quality of life, and other every type of social issue involved in the quality of your environment, your neighborhood, your home, was sort of disregarded for a long time, and the environmental justice movement sort of reaction to that. Sorry, someone's calling me.
That's all right.
Hello?
Hi, Thomas.
Hey, how you doing? Of waste management and was brought back to rehabilitate the EPA in the Reagan administration after the first big scandals in the Reagan administration in the first term, which they called Sewergate, where a couple of their top administrators went to jail for lying to Congress, perjury type things.
Mm-hmm.
Rita Lavelle and Ann Burford Gorsuch. Can't remember. I can't believe I remember those names. But yeah, they basically came into the EPA, turned into a corporate whorehouse. Excuse me, my French. And you know, were giving away permits like candy, and you know, spending all their time at lunch with polluters and stuff like that, and lying to Congress about it. And so a couple of them ended up going to jail about it. At least one of them, and I think two of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You had mentioned that from your resume I reviewed that you became a member of the Evergreen Alliance. Can you tell me about your involvement with that alliance?
The Evergreen Alliance evolved out of a neighborhood group in response to the news that the city of Detroit was planning to build the world's largest trash incinerator within a half mile of all our homes, half mile where we're sitting here in Wayne State today.
So it was more of a neighborhood group?
It was
group
a neighborhood
then?
Group. It was purely a neighborhood group. It started out with maybe 12, 14, no more than 16 people in a friend's living room. The way I always describe it is we had never used the words waste management policy consecutively in our lives. And we ended up spending five years, five longer years of all of our lives trying to organize resistance to this giant trash incinerator with some success, although it got built and it's operated and it's still operating.
Mm-hmm.
The requirement to retrofit it with you know, over $500 million worth of pollution control equipment was quite extraordinary. And the basin-wide consciousness of things like environmental justice, although we didn't use those words at the time,
was even more extraordinary. What words were
pollution, contamination, disease, racism. The environmental justice movement in those terms was not something that anybody talked about until the 90s. This was in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
there was the timing was exquisite, really. I mean, it was within months of the hearings on the city going deep into HOC to pay for the retrofit of the incinerator that Clinton signed the executive order, and the words environmental justice and the environmental justice movement became something that people talked about and consciously tried to form. So it was proto-environmental justice, really, is what it was.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned it was more of a neighborhood group, or pretty much a neighborhood group. Did it ever grow more than just the neighborhood group?
It did. I mean, it became part of a basin-wide network. I mean, there was the Zero Discharge Alliance, including groups like Greenpeace and Great Lakes United, was all around the basin. And the province of Ontario and the North Cass Community Union, which is the neighborhood group here, and the Audubon Society and the Sierra Club, and I think Environmental Defense Fund, you know, three big national environmental organizations, were all part of litigation against the incinerator, which we were aware of and in conversation with, but not actively promoting.
Mm-hmm.
Litigation was kind of a bust. One of the lessons of this whole thing has been how difficult it is to get any progress in the courts on these issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was, you mentioned the support from all of those agencies. What was some of like the opposition and just other people, maybe institutions or other places that wanted to have this facility built? What was that like?
Combustion Engineering Corporation was the prime contractor. Weston Engineering did the environmental impact analysis. Of course, the city of Detroit, led by Mayor Coleman Young at the time, who was at the time the most powerful political official in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
The Honigman Miller Law Firm was their lawyers. Detroit Edison, now DET Energy, was in the mix because they were going to buy and sell the energy and steam and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Waste Management was going to dispose of the ash. Those are the principal ones, and I probably left out a couple others too. Those mm-hmm. are the main ones.
The main ones.
Five or six major corporations in the city of Detroit,
mm-hmm.
and the state was the permitting authority.
Mm-hmm. Did they ever try to meet with your group or anything, or even the other groups that were opposed to it?
No, they held public. They held public meetings that you had the right to come and be heard on, but mm-hmm. they never.
Tried never to met personally with your group or anything.
No,
okay.
Absolutely no.
All right.
No, they would in those days. Michigan had a couple of things. One was called the Toxic Substance Control Commission, which was an innovative body that was created in, I think, the late 60s or early 70s after the PBB incident. I don't know if you ever heard of that, but what happened was some fire retardant chemicals was inadvertently mixed with animal feed.
Okay.
It had, what was it, PBB, polyethyl bromide biphenyl.
Uh-huh.
I don't know exactly what chemical it was, but everybody always calls it PBB. It's highly carcinogenic. They fed it to these animals, and then they realized that it was in, you know, the meat and so forth, in the milk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big problem. A lot of people in Michigan, probably myself included, a bunch of people, carry a fairly heavier body burden of carcinogens for that reason alone, because food chain exposure is big time.
Mm-hmm.
And after that happened, this group called the Toxic Substance Control Commission was formed by the state, by legislation, to deal with situations like that. Where if we have a toxic substance emergency, investigate it right away, find out what goes on, and make the appropriate orders to protect public health. Well, the Toxic Substance Control Commission got a hold of some of the ash produced by the incinerator in its trial operations in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they got a hold of it was because the workers were getting sick. They were having nosebleeds and dizziness and generalized fatigue and rashes, and they walked off at one point, and the construction company and combustion engineer were fined for workplace violations. And some of them took some of the ash, gave it to the Toxic Substance Control Commission. The Toxic Substance Control Commission tested it and found that it had very high levels of lead and cadmium in it. I think other things too. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that stick in my mind. And suggested that it should be, well, it didn't suggest. They said, well, under the law, under Michigan law, this has to be stored in a hazardous waste landfill, you know, especially designed landfill, which is mm-hmm. very expensive, right?
Yeah.
It's hazardous waste. So they changed the law. They did two things. They linguistically detoxified the ash. They said incinerator ash is special ash. You can uh-huh. put it in a special, quote unquote, since we're on recording, I'm making quote marks with my special cell of a landfill. And, it'll be characterized as "quote unquote" special waste, and isn't that great? Isn't that wonderful for public health? And then the other thing they did, of course, was they eliminated the Toxic Substance Control Commission.
Mm-hmm.
A few years later, we had a thing called the Michigan Air Pollution Control Commission, which had appointed members, some appointed by the governor, some appointed as public interest representatives, some appointed by the legislature, etc. And they were the permit granting authority, and it was them who denied the operating permit for the incinerator in April 1990.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there isn't any Air Pollution Control Commission anymore either. So that was part of the dynamic, was we would, you know, this ragtag group of people, as Coleman Young called us, this little group of radicals in the Cass Corridor, would go in and beat them in these licensing proceedings. And mm-hmm. they would have to spend a bunch of money and eliminate the forum. Mm-hmm. So now, today, those permits are granted by one official within the executive branch. They hold hearings, but I mean, the hearings are a joke, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can say anything you want to them, but thank you very much, you know. Uh-huh. It's permits granted.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, that was the evolution of the policy environment throughout this.
Mm-hmm. Now, with being a resident in the city and in the Evergreen Alliance, being in the city with actual neighborhoods, the mayor, Coleman Young, really didn't have much to do with your group or anything? Or
nothing. No, I remember a friend of mine went up to him early in the struggle, happened to run into him in the lobby of one of the buildings downtown. I think it was the Penobscot building. And so he's got a lot of guts. So he just went up to him and he said, "Mr. Mayor, are you going to stop building that incinerator?" And Coleman just looked at him and said, "The money's already spent, son." You know, what Coleman said, what was really shocking was that the day after the Air Pollution Control Commission voted to deny the operating permit, Coleman blew a gasket and told the media that he was led to believe that the vote was going to go the other way. You know, this licensing commission's vote was apparently, he thought, fixed in, you know, a backroom agreement between him and Governor Blanchard,
mm-hmm.
which is not something you typically want to say publicly if it's true, you know. You know, Coleman was getting on at that point. He, you know, this was a guy who had a magnificent progressive origin, and how he went from, you know, labor organizer, the man who stood up to the House Un-American Activities Committee and first black mayor of Detroit, to the public agent of this giant incinerator and the other corporate things he did, the coal town plan, et cetera, is a story in and of itself. It's never really been told, and somebody ought to tell it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little before my time, but I mean, that's another hole.
Another hole.
It was the political context for this is what it was.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, you were not going to be able to, what we learned and what we should have known from the beginning, and we probably did know it, but we just didn't care. You were not going to organize around an environmental issue in the 80s in Detroit against Coleman Young, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was a, you know, he was the acknowledged leader of the city, and the, you know, the people that vote for him were not going to turn on him because of environmental issues.
Uh-huh.
Primarily because of race and everything attended to it.
Uh-huh. Okay. I think also from your resume I read that you were, in 1991, you brought suit against the Michigan EPA against the owners and the operators of the trash incinerator.
Yeah, the DNR. Yeah, well, we tried to appeal. After they denied the permit, they turned around and had a special meeting and entered into a consent order and gave them a permit.
Uh-huh.
On the condition that they do this retrofit, right,
uh-huh.
which cost them way over $500 million, and under Michigan law, under the procedures, I was a young lawyer at the time, right? You have 21 days to appeal such an administrative finding. We filed such an appeal and a lawsuit
mm-hmm.
in order to preserve the rights. But I always said I'm not going to pursue this by myself. I'm not going to, you know, fight Honigman and you know, the state attorney general and all these corporate, you know.
Uh-huh.
And we wanted, what happened was we wanted trial lawyers for public justice, a national
public interest law firm to take the case, and they just wouldn't do it.
It was just too controversial and not.
You know, you'd have to ask them why they didn't do it. I'm sure I have some information and stuff, but there's no point in me talking about it. it was not. It was not something that it was worth it for them.
Uh huh. Okay. All right. So with unsuccessfully having that lawsuit go through, was there any type of more activism to try to still get it shut down?
There was, because the next stage of it was going to the city council to get the finances approved for the retrofit. And at that point, we appeared in front of city council and argued what a bad deal it was and how the failure of the plant and its tests to meet the standards for lead, cadmium, dioxins and furans, and hydrochloric acid was a breach of contract, and they should not, they should give it back to Combustion Engineering because they breached their contract. Mm-hmm. And we did get City Council President Marianne Matthews' vote on that.
Okay.
We actually turned one vote on the City Council, for whatever that's worth. Councilman Mel Ravitz wrote a great statement in conformity with his in connection with his vote for it, in which he acknowledged it was a terrible deal, but basically said, "Look, we have no choice. This is the policy that the mayor has chosen for our solid waste disposal, and although it's a terrible deal, to say no to it without an alternative, it makes no sense to him." Mm-hmm. And if you flash forward today to the bankruptcy, of course, this is always the argument, right? There is no alternative.
Yeah.
Going back to Margaret Thatcher in England in the late 70s and the Reagan administration, the claim always is on behalf of corporate power and their political supporters and allies, this is the way it has to be. There is really no alternative, by which they mean that there is no alternative that is consistent with maintaining their power and the system that benefits them in the way that they intend and desire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what happened, and that's continuing to happen.
So political, the politics are...
I think the word is neoliberalism.
Okay.
That's the word. If traditional liberalism is a market-based economy,
uh-huh,
in which prices are set by free interaction of economic actors who, you and I decide to dispose of our trash or grow our food or sell our food or transport, that contract, leads to the greatest goods of the greater number. Neoliberalism is the effective support of giant private economic entities, corporations,
mm-hmm,
by government deregulation, lowering taxation, lowering labor standards, enforcing draconian terms of employment, busting unions and work,
mm-hmm,
and those particular things that have come to characterize the time that we live in and produced this unbelievable inequality that we have now, that is the sort of the condition of everything that we face economically, politically, and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? It's 85 people have as much wealth, income, property as 3.5 billion people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's the latest that I saw in a. It wasn't UNICEF. It was another standard. Oxfam. There's a recent Oxfam study that equated the richest 85 people in the world as having the equivalent of 3.5 billion. I would say things are out of balance. I think that this whole Evergreen Alliance versus the incinerator and all the corporations that it rode in on was an early skirmish in the acceleration of that process,
mm-hmm,
in the 80s.
Do you feel there's still unbalance in Detroit with, wealth distribution and, representation?
I mean, that's what the plan of adjustment, the bankruptcy and emergency management is all about.
Uh-huh.
You have a system where in 2007 and 2008, the arrangements that were put in place back in the 70s, at the time the incinerator was planned and designed, the globalization of capital, the financialization of the economy, the deregulation, what I mentioned before, union busting, mm-hmm, lower taxes. Through the contradictions of that system, the inequality in particular, and the overcapacity, you had this crash, you have this epic recession,
or
great recession, and somebody's got to pay, right? I mean, it's like you send somebody to the store and he didn't come back with the money, and he didn't come back with dinner, you know, so who's going to pay this? And so, what has been happening in the last couple of years in Detroit is the continued evolution of that process where, well, we're just going to take it away from the city's workers and retirees, you know, because there's a bunch of capital out there in their pension fund and we can get that, you know, and while we're at it, in order to make it totally, in order to rationalize it, we're also going to give the bondholders a haircut, which they did, but, you know, about 80% of the debt that they eliminated came out of the workers' sides.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you seen in the past 20 years or so, it's gotten better with, like, the wealth distribution and more representation?
No, it's gotten worse. No, it's gotten way worse.
How do you say it's gotten worse?
Well, like I said, for one thing, we used to have a Toxic Substance Control Commission. We used to have a Michigan Air Pollution Control Commission. In the 80s, nobody would say, as Senator Richard Durbin said a few years ago, that the banks own Congress. Mm-hmm. Citizens United. Every single United States Supreme Court justice appointed to that court since the 1970s has been not a little bit, not arguably, but significantly to the right of his or her predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing has significant consequences. And, you know, when Republican presidents have appointed justices and judges, also not only the justices, but the lower court, they've done it on an ideological basis. And when Democrats have done it, they've done it on a technocratic basis. So there's been a consistent political bias built into the judiciary. The money and the election system is completely out of control now with Citizens United and everything else. And so it's gotten way worse to the point where it's absolutely frightening at this point, and it literally threatens all of our survival.
Because mm-hmm.
when you look at the effects on the climate and the effects of the climate on things like food production and the availability of water, I mean, people in California today, people in the Great Lakes in the middle of this freshwater blessing Monroe County and Lucas County in Ohio just last summer couldn't drink the water.
Yeah.
So, you know, and within a few weeks of that, we had a big rainstorm here that, flooded the, it's a miracle more people weren't killed.
Mm-hmm.
We are in a very, very precarious time. We have a lot of distractions, electronic, pharmaceutical, emotional, political, cultural and in every other way, but if you pay attention to what's going on, if you're not scared, well, anybody that's paying attention is scared, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Can you tell me more about the Michigan Environmental Justice Coalition, which you were founder of?
Yeah, the Michigan Environmental Justice Coalition was something, we're skipping over some of the history here, and I didn't realize we were going to get that far, but I can do that.
Yeah.
After the incinerator fight and after the retrofit, in the 90s, there was, of course, we started to talk about environmental justice, and there was a pair of activists, well, it's a small group of activists, but the pair that I'm thinking of is the late Janice O'Neill and her aunt, the late Lillian Robinson, both of whom have passed away since, and Father Phil Schmitter and the late Sister Joanne Chivarini in Flint, and they were getting really sick. They live in the, I don't know if you're familiar with Flint, but, you know, the north side of Flint is basically the black side of town.
Yeah.
And the suburbs of the north are very white and pretty well-to-do, other than parts of Grand Blanc. Both parts of Grand Blanc to the south and also Mount Morris Township and so forth are pretty well-to-do. And what Mount Morris Township was doing was they were siting industrial and waste processing facilities on the edge of town where the emissions went over to the north side of Flint.
Uh-huh.
And the people I mentioned, Janice O'Neill in particular, who was an absolute heroine, unsung heroine of environmental justice in Michigan, took exception to that happening again. And what happened was in the late 80s or the early 90s, in the very last days of the Michigan Air Pollution Control Commission, they kicked up a big fuss about something called the Genesee Power Station.
Okay.
Which was to be a wood waste incinerator, and ironically, in the DNR file, in the first meetings that the developer had with the regulators, they described its mission as to burn crack houses from Detroit.
Okay.
So there was this big controversy about how bad this facility was going to be, which turned into a debate over the nature of the feedstock. And we filed a lawsuit, and by we I mean the Morris and Jane Sugar Law Center, and myself as co-counsel, Michael Haddad as co-counsel. And in the first round of that lawsuit, which I was not personally involved in other than reviewing the pleadings, Then-Judge Valdemar Washington in Genesee County Circuit sent the parties to mediation, or to settlement talks, really. And the Genesee Power Station agreed not to burn so much construction and demolition debris. They agreed to limit their, the crack houses in Detroit, quote-unquote, to the, in other words, the paint-contaminated wood to a very small percentage. I think it was 20% or something. And to primarily burn, like, you know, brush, right? And so that was clearly a result that was as good as we could even possibly hope to achieve through litigation. So that settlement was entered. But we had also sued the DNR. And so with that claim still remaining, and Judge Washington resigned, and the case was assigned to his successor, Judge Archie Hayman, the question became, well, what are we going to do about that? And we were, from our position, we were like, okay, well, as far as we're concerned, this is done. We settled it. We'll just dismiss it without prejudice. And the DNR under Engler, being the, I'll just say on the tape, being the evil motherfuckers that they were, said, oh, so you'll agree that there's no violation of, there's no environmental justice here, injustice or environmental racism, there's no discrimination. You'll agree to dismiss it on the merits that they, that you lose, you don't have a case, there's nothing to complain about here, right? And we said, well, no. You know, I mean, there's a difference between dismissing a case that hasn't been litigated without prejudice and admitting that, that it's not, we don't agree that it's not right. We just think that we could spend our time doing something else better. And we even said, well, what do you mean? What if we admitted there's no intentional discrimination? Because that becomes a big legal issue in environmental justice. Are we talking about disparate impact from a facially neutral policy, or are we talking about intentional racism? That becomes a big issue. They said, no, we want you to admit that there's nothing. So they forced us to go to trial on it. And that was when I got involved, and I tried the case with Kerry Moss, who's the ACLU now, and we got an injunction from Archie Hayman. He said, don't grant any more permits until you deal with this issue. So they were quite humiliated by that. Archie made himself a big hero. But he did it in a very strange procedural way. He granted the injunction on the subsequent section of the Michigan Constitution, the one involving the general welfare, as opposed to the one we pled, which was the one involving the environment, section 51 and 52, I think, or 52 and 53. And what we did then is what any competent lawyer would do, is we said, all right, well, we'll move to amend the pleadings. We want to go under that. We want to include that in our complaint. And it's perfectly fair because, in fact, the case was tried on that basis because the DNR's defense was, hey, our policy defend everybody. And Archie looked at it and said, well, I don't agree. And you know, he was an interesting guy. But that's another whole story. trying to get, like I say, you're out of the story here. What happened was, of course, they appealed, and they appealed on the basis that it was an unpled theory, and he wouldn't let us amend the pleadings. So, of course, the Court of Appeals reversed. In a 2-1 decision with Judge Kathleen Jansen saying it should go back and be tried, that we should be allowed to amend, and then retry it on that theory, which was interesting because Kathleen Jansen had been running for the Michigan Supreme Court and had recently lost a close race after ruling in a very prominent case involving regulatory takings, which is another part of this whole conundrum, you know. And so I think she was somewhat sensitive to how important these issues were. The other two just said, we just reverse it because this is a procedural mess. And they were right, it was a procedural mess. I mean, Archie basically got himself on the news in Flint for 2 whole weeks defending the community and then managed to get rid of the case. You got to hand it to the guy. Some of these guys just know how to exercise power, let's face it.
Do you still work with the Michigan Environmental Justice Coalition?
There's a new Michigan Environmental Justice Coalition, and they did a statewide seminar about a few weeks ago. I was just looking at some notes from it. Oh, it was on my computer. And I spoke there about some of this history. Haven't heard anything back since. I'm not sure what they're doing exactly. It's a different group, really.
It's not really same Minnesota. Name.
There's got to be, there's some continuity in the groups, but the Michigan Environmental Justice Coalition that I was involved in was in the early 90s. It was after the Flint lawsuit. After the Flint lawsuit, we said, all right, well, what do we do next? And we formed this coalition, and we had several Michigan legislators, including the leader of it, Kwame Kilpatrick, the then minority leader in the state Senate, sponsor environmental justice legislation. And I don't remember the details of the legislation. I think basically what it did was it just established that environmental discrimination would be the equivalent of a violation of the Michigan Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act, which was the theory that we had try the
the flood
case on. So that was, and he did introduce that, but it died in, in committee. And then he got busy running for mayor.
For mayor, okay. You also mentioned earlier in the interview you worked for the Maurice and Jane Sugar Law Center. And you were pretty much involved in making sure that you adapted environmental justice as part of the litigation program. What were some of the challenges that were dealt with this when investing in that type of law?
Resources, politics, neoliberalism. It's very hard to get. I mean, it's notorious in the environmental justice arena that the funds that are available for environmental work are disproportionately in traditional environmental movement type issues, and the environmental justice movement is overwhelmingly underfunded. So yeah, it was a, it was somewhat rewarding to do it for a while. I couldn't possibly make a living doing it. And, you know, the law center still exists. It's got a smaller staff now. And it does all kinds of great work. I was a cooperating attorney with them in the Flint case, and then I was a part-time employee for a while after that. And I was just doing a few cases. On my own.
What has been some of the most disappointing parts of being an activist for environmental justice in Detroit and Michigan?
Well, the fact that incinerator is still operating is horrible. The fact that we haven't made any real progress on environmental justice as a policy is terribly frustrating. The lack of equity in the investment of resources and in the mainstream evaluation of the issues, all of those things are terribly frustrating.
How about on the flip side, something that's been extremely satisfying?
Well, it's been extremely satisfying to be part of, you know, something that is really on the cutting edge of social justice activism for decades. And there are some very, very dynamic people, especially if you take environmental justice and appreciate it with the breadth of it, as not just in the terms of the narrow environmental definition that you read earlier, but in terms of how it connects up with, you know, transportation and housing and security and education and literally everything else. In 2010, we hosted the second U.S. Social Forum here in Detroit, and it was very clear that the people that were from all over the country that were instrumental in that were very active and involved and informed on environmental justice issues. And some of, they were some of the most dynamic people I've ever been associated with. Very proud to be associated and work with them. And the people from Detroit that worked on that project were also, you know, environmental justice associated people, and there was a giant march at the incinerator at the end of the U.S. Social Forum.
That was in 2010.
So you know, there's just been, and like I say, I was asked to speak at a conference a month or two ago, and you're still doing this here. It's good that we're documenting this. We have video. It needs to be assembled into a project that tells the story. It's definitely been the thing to do because, you know, there's no, we always saw this at the time. The whole basis was to recognize that this isn't just a question of how we dispose of trash or whether this particular corporation gets the a contract to build this particular facility. This is an essential part of decisions that we have to make that have that are essential to the stage of history that we're in right now and the stage of development of industrial civilization that we live in, our health, you know, how we define justice, progress, economic growth and economic productivity, all these things. And it was always, it was very clear, you know, people were starting to talk about global warming at the time and climate. It was always clear that if we just continued along the path of paying giant industrial corporations a premium to quote-unquote solve problems, which didn't solve them at all but simply created greater problems, that we were going to be facing the potential catastrophe that we're facing today with our water and our land and our air. You know, I mean, the air is a little bit behind it right now, mostly because, well, not if you count the climate, our, the carbon dioxide in the air. We are in enormous risk. I don't know if you've looked at Naomi Klein's new book, This Changes That Climate Versus Capitalism, but this changes everything. You know, if you really look at the state, at the situation we face, we have to go to the most fundamental issues and make decisions about how we do everything that protect us from these, from this catastrophe. It's analogous to fighting fascism 70 years ago, except it's even worse. You know, it's like all this other shit that everybody says is, well, but where are the jobs going to come from, or who's going to be, you know, who's going to get the credit for it, or who's going to be the leaders? You know, no, this is an emergency. Our children's health and survival is threatened by all this stuff. And that was really what it came from, was that we recognized this was coming. I don't think, maybe we didn't realize it was going to be this bad even, but, you know, we saw it coming and we said, well, we're going to at least try to, you know, speak truth to power about it. And so it's good to feel that you did that, you know. It would be, it's at the same time, it's very frustrating because we're still, if you want to, I mean, there was an environmental justice conference here in Detroit about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, and I was asked to speak at that. And several of the leaders from around the country were there, people who I had known through their articles and through emails and had never met personally. And every one of them said the same thing. Is the sad thing is that if you ask, the EPA was there, it was an EPA-sponsored conference, if you ask us what are the next steps in environmental justice, we can go back to the outlines that we had in 1989, 1993, and it would be the exact same outline. You just print it out from the computer, and here it is. This is the program. That's where we're at, and that's, you know, and I mean that, and that's why, you know, people can't drink water out of Lake Erie in the summer of 2014, and why, you know, you have this environmental, this climate emergency at the stage where it's at. Where, I mean, fortunately, there's a new accord between the United States and China, so maybe it's, you know, maybe there's some shift on this. Is it too little, too late? Only time will tell.
Okay. What advice would you have for somebody that wants to get involved in environmental justice issues or activism, especially in Detroit, even with the incinerator now? Or
I think the same old advice goes well. Think globally and act locally.
All right.
Recognize that political change, social change, is a long game. It's not a short game. You know, you don't just make an argument to somebody and expect everything to change. But that if you're dedicated to it, and if you spend the time to learn it, and spend the time to do it right, and build the kinds of connections and alliances, build the kind of movement that is the only thing that's ever made any good difference in this stuff, then it's the most rewarding thing you could possibly do, because it is the right thing to do.
Are you still active in trying to get the incinerator shut down?
Not the incinerator shut down so much, although I will go to their meetings. I think it's basically falling of its own weight. It's so old. The problem that's come up now is that the smells are getting worse. They're not getting any better. Not exactly sure why that is, but there's a lot of course, investment in Midtown, what they call Midtown, what used to be called the Cass Corridor. And those folks are upset about that, which leads to a really obnoxious dynamic because, well, what are you saying? Now that white people live in the corridor, you know, it's all of a sudden it's got to go. It was fine until then. So that's sort of going on. And no, I'm not personally involved in it, although I'm sort of in dialogue and, you know, in touch with those people.
Last month, the Detroit News paper published an article about kind of like a settlement or a deal that was reached with the incinerator operators, Waste Energy and Detroit Renewable Power. They just kind of outlined that they were getting fined quite a bit and they have to re-engineer their facility to reroute the odors. Do you feel that that was enough, or they're doing enough?
I think it was pure window dressing. And the article was so bad that it's impossible for me to know, because the article talked about destroying the bad air, which whatever the hell that means.
Destruction of the odor.
You have to have some journalists with some basic competence, which clearly they didn't have there. I mean, the timing of it was very strange, of course. It's a settlement with Bill Schuette, just as he's running for election. It's a 2-year process. We mean it this time. I'm shaking my finger for the recording. We mean it this time. You really better clean up your act. That was what I was referring to a minute ago when I said really what seems to be going on here is everybody saying, oh, well, now that white people live here and Midtown is supposedly, you know, the great middle class frontier of Detroit, now we have to do something about this. That lawsuit was filed by, as I understand it, Midtown and people who are members of the Sumozi Midtown Development Association. I think that's who filed it. And I got the sense it was really a political sweetheart deal with Schuette. they don't want to spend the kind of money you got to spend to really litigate this. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a, you know, this is the same reason that I didn't want to spend. I didn't have the kind of money when I was a young law student and filed that case.
Uh-huh.
And it would be, frankly, insane for them to spend the money, because now, in 1991, we were looking at a brand new facility with its whole life ahead of it. This facility is it's going to end at some point. It's just old now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Do you see any time in the future, in the next 50 years, even if it's still going to be there?
Oh, no, it's not going to be there 50 years. It couldn't possibly last that long. I think part of the reason it smells so bad now is that it's just physically deteriorating. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it's, everything about it is contaminated with so much grease and residue from so many years of burning and dumping. It's it's not even so much burning as I understand it, it's the pile of waste.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is what I told them was, you know, you're sitting here telling the community, I happened to be at one of the Midtown community meetings because I was asked to meet a friend there for, and this, actually it's part of the seminar for the Great Lake this week. And they were there speaking to the community, and they said, well, we just don't know what's causing the smells. I said, come on, this is Detroit. Yeah. This facility's been here for 20 years. If you pile up 3,000 tons of garbage a day, it's going to smell, okay? You know, this is not complicated. and that's my position. I'm sticking to it, you know. I mean, I think that that's the situation. Once you make the decision not only to burn, but to dump so much solid waste, size has always been essential to this thing, you have to deal with the complications.
Uh-huh.
Now, if it's a city like Detroit, the previous 20 years where you just don't care about the people, as clearly they don't, then fine, it's the price you're willing to pay.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got a situation now where this area around this incinerator is supposedly this great development deal, now they have problems.
Mm-hmm. All right. Do you have anything else to add for environmental justice?
We've been over a lot of stuff. You know? it goes on. It's got to go on. This, uh-huh. You know, we need to get a grip on these issues.
Uh-huh.
And it's not only environmental. It's, you know, who has the right, they call it the right to the city, right? You know, mm-hmm. Who has the ability to participate meaningfully in the process of urbanization and altering the urban trajectory, environment, development, process. And, you know, that's really, I mean, Detroit, of course, is still ground zero for that,
mm-hmm.
nationally or even globally in terms of the industrialized world, for the very same reasons that we're involved in the incinerator. The nature of the local power structure, the nature of the character and intent of capital in this particular region, in particular, the regional dynamic. You know, there's no other city in North America that built a wall around its central city to the same extent that Detroit did.
Uh-huh.
And you know, that is just a fundamental reality that somehow we have to deal with. It appears that their decision is, well, there's 600,000 people in Detroit, and half of them are, you know, black and Latino, and they're poor as dirt. Who cares?
Uh-huh.
That appears to be their policy. And, it, you know, we'll see how that works out for you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you for your time today.
Pleasure meeting you.
Yes, pleasure meeting you.
Yeah,
thank you.
So you live in